Last September, Eastern Kentucky University professor Peter Kraska testified before a hearing of the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee.
What we saw played out in the Ferguson protests was the application of a very common mindset, style of uniform, and appearance and weaponry used every day in the homes of private residences during SWAT raids. Some departments conduct as many as 500 SWAT team raids a year. It is the poor and communities of color that are most impacted.
Today on Eastern Standard, we will talk with Dr. Kraska about the expansion of police militarization in the U.S. We're interested in hearing from you. Send your question or comment before the show to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKUEST or post on the Facebook page. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. In recent years, there has been what appears to be a noticeable increase in the use of military surplus equipment by local branches of law enforcement. This was especially so after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Today's guest says we are in the midst of a, quote, historic shift in American democratic governance. Dr. Peter Kraska says the distinction between our civilian police and the military is blurring in significant and consequential ways. How did this come to be? Is this increase in necessity of the times in which we live, or just a case of militaristic overkill? On this week's Eastern Standard, we are joined by Eastern Kentucky University Dr. Peter Kraska, professor and chair of graduate studies and research at EKU School of Justice Studies. Dr. Kraska is a nationally recognized scholar in the areas of police and criminal justice militarization, criminal justice theory, and mixed methods research. Dr. Kraska has worked in the criminal justice system for many years, but began his career as a pilot fishing guide in Alaska, an interesting view into the personality. That's, what, 20-some years ago, Dr. Kraska?
Quite a few years ago, yes.
Peter Kraska, thank you so much for being with us for this Eastern Standard program.
Thank you.
We're going to invite listeners to be part of our conversation as we discuss militarization of our police. 800-621-8890 is the phone number. You'll be welcome to call. If you'd like to get on the line with your question, comment, or personal story, you're welcome to do that right now, but it'll be a little while before we put a phone call on the air. You can send us an email, as at least one person has done already, to WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Post on the WEKU Facebook page. We'll be monitoring that page. Or send us a tweet at WEKUEST. And let's begin by just going back a number of months. Last year, actually, this was in September, Dr. Peter Kraska was invited to testify before the U.S. Senate on the subject of police militarization. The segment that we have here begins with two examples of what Dr. Kraska describes as extreme police militarization.
In September of 2000, federal law enforcement conducted a joint drug investigation with the Modesto, California Police Department. Employing the military special operations model, the Modesto's PD SWAT team conducted a pre-dawn dynamic entry into a family's home. Suspecting the father, it turned out incorrectly of being involved in low-level drug dealing. One of the children in the home, Alberto, was 11 years old and complied with all of the officer's screams to get into the prone position on his bedroom floor. A paramilitary police officer standing over him with a 12-gauge shotgun then accidentally discharged his weapon into Alberto's back, killing him. Now move forward to May of this year. A Georgia Police Department SWAT team concluded a no-knock drug raid on a family's private residence. The officers threw a percussion grenade into the home. The device landed in an infant's crib next to his face, and then it detonated. Despite being comatose for a number of days and receiving severe lacerations and burns, the baby did survive. Not that it should matter, but the family was not involved in drug dealing. Some might dismiss these cases as mere anecdotes, but the facts, based on extensive national-level scientific research, are clear. These examples are emblematic of an historic, yet up until recently little publicly noticed, shift in American democratic governance. The clear distinction between our civilian police and military is blurring in significant and consequential ways. The research I've been conducting since 1989 has documented quantitatively and qualitatively the steady and certain march of U.S. civilian policing down the militarization continuum, culturally, materially, operationally, and organizationally, despite massive efforts at democratizing police under the guise of community policing reforms.
Eastern Kentucky University Professor Dr. Peter Kraska speaking before a hearing of the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Not easy to listen to, probably not easy work to do, Dr. Kraska. Talk about the background. Why were you invited to speak to this committee? And we want to hear a little bit more about the incidents that you were discussing with the U.S. senators.
Sure. First of all, I was invited to the U.S. Senate by two different senators. And it's kind of interesting because it does give us a sense of the ideological context to this particular police militarization. I had Senator McCaskill contact me and Senator Coburn from Oklahoma, both being very much on opposite ends of the ideological continuum, but both also being very concerned about this trend. And so I came as both of their guests, and that was based on doing, as I said in the little clip there, that, you know, I've been researching this now since 1989. I've done a lot of national level research on it, as well as the kinds of anecdotes that I talked about. And so they wanted someone to come in that could provide some historical context and some good, hard data on this whole phenomenon of police militarization.
Of course, you know, the U.S. Congress hasn't done a lot in the last couple of years. Was there any action taken as a result of this testimony, or is there still some legislation pending?
There is legislation pending. A lot of activity has taken place. The Senate has tried to do some things. The House has tried to do some things. And then most recently, the White House has gotten real involved. I've served on a couple of different White House commissions in the last few months, and have been communicating with those commissions and writing out survey responses. They haven't invited me there yet. I don't suspect they will, because really what they've decided on is, this is the White House, they've really decided on not tackling the real issues. Surprise, surprise. They've decided on just doing some periphery things and some cosmetic things that give the illusion that something's actually going to be accomplished, but the kinds of steps they're taking won't accomplish much.
Okay, well, I'll take the bait. What are these real issues underlying this extreme militarization of police?
Well, so let's start with some of the piecemeal things they're talking about doing. So, for example, they're concerned and express a lot of public concerns about taking war discards from Iraq and Afghanistan and bringing them into local police departments, and having those local police departments having armored personnel carriers, MRAPs, M16s, all kinds of military gear. And their first intention was to either stop that program altogether or to slow it down. Ultimately, though, what's occurred is that the White House has decided that the best way to handle it is to not stop it or slow the materials down. It's to provide more training for the local police departments in how to use this military gear. Hmm. Now, as you can imagine, all of those for-profit training entities are salivating at the possibility of lots more federal dollars being put into further training local police on how to do military goods. The real difficulty ends up being that the local police departments are probably going to be getting their training from the U.S. military themselves, or from for-profit training camps, kind of like what Blackwater was, but there are all kinds of them, and they'll be training them how to use these kinds of military goods in a unavoidably military way. So I would contend that it's just going to perpetuate the problem, not fix anything.
So that's really what was the impetus for our considering to do this program, hearing that local communities were going to be receiving and in some cases, you know, trying to find a place to house a tank, which I guess would be an extreme case. But I assume equipment like that has been made available to local county state governments. Is that the case in Kentucky? Are there any places in Kentucky where they have received awards of these kinds of military gear and equipment that would go far beyond what would normally be needed, in your opinion?
According to the national statistics that were put out as a result of the Senate hearings, Kentucky law enforcement doesn't have its hands as deep into this type of material as a lot of states do. That doesn't mean it's not happening. That doesn't mean that they're not getting bayonets and M16s and MRAPs. And some of that's happening, but not near to the extent that it is in a lot of states. And I suspect that's because in a lot of Kentucky local police departments, there's a lot more local accountability, where if the police decided to do that kind of thing or make a display of that kind of weaponry, there would be a lot more pushback. And, of course, you have a lot of intact, informal communication going on in local communities in Kentucky, and they would say something, hey, chief, or hey, sheriff, you know, that doesn't look appropriate. And so there are more checks and balances at least in most local areas in Kentucky. I remember I went and testified in front of the Kentucky House and Senate, and they had a hearing on this particular issue. And I testified alongside a chief of police who's the head of the Kentucky Association of Chiefs of Police. And he did talk about them having bayonets and the importance of having all of these goods. As you can imagine, we had a pretty good debate.
I know, and this issue of surplus military equipment coming to local, state, regional governments, police forces is a relatively recent occurrence. But you talk about extreme militarization of police going back into the 1980s. Why has this not been an issue? How did that start occurring in the 1980s?
Yeah, one of my, I think, probably most important clarifications I like to make or a myth of militarized policing is that it has everything to do with 9/11. So we had this real knee-jerk reaction to 9/11, and so we had the movement towards homeland security, and so you had actual active-duty military people training the police at local level, and all these things took off, when in actuality, that's not even remotely the case.
I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and take our station break, and then we'll pick it up right there, because I know our listeners are going to be interested in hearing where you make this distinction and where this began to occur in the 1980s. Police militarization, our topic on this week's Eastern Standard. We're interested in your questions, your comments, your personal stories. Have you had an encounter with police where you felt that the force was more military than policing? Are you concerned about our police agencies becoming increasingly militarized? 800-621-8890 is the phone number. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest or post on the WEKU Facebook page. That number again, 800-621-8890.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Police militarization is the topic of this week's Eastern Standard. And, of course, use of music and TV themes is not in any way, we do not want to detract from the seriousness of this very important issue. We invite you to participate in our conversation by calling 800-621-8890. Send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. Our guest, Dr. Peter Kraska, of Eastern Kentucky University School of Justice Studies has testified before the U.S. Senate Homeland Security Committee and I guess elsewhere, and involved in instruction for law enforcement personnel who come to Richmond and the Eastern Kentucky University campus constantly. There's a constant stream of law enforcement personnel who come through Richmond. Police militarization is not all about 9/11, you say, and it has its roots in the 80s or beyond, even farther back?
Well, yeah, I won't bother to get farther back because we could talk about the French model and the British model and all those kinds of things. But the more recent surge of police militarization absolutely began in the mid and late 1980s, and it was the result of a few converging factors. First, remember that we had the end of the Cold War occur, and so the U.S. military itself was looking for to not have a peacetime dividend and more of a reason for their existence since the end of the Cold War. That happened. Simultaneously with that, we had the late 1980s and early 1990s very intense drug war. War on crack, war on drugs. And so what we saw was the military itself being pushed by politicians to get involved in more domestic law enforcement, to do more training with domestic law enforcement, to do more joint drug operations with domestic law enforcement. And at the same time, we saw the local police departments really embrace the war on drug rhetoric and start using SWAT teams, essentially, a role that they had never been used for before in this way, to actually go inside people's private residences and do drug searches.
So take the metaphor of the war on drugs and actually execute it as a war in a very literal sense.
Absolutely. Of course, different rules of engagement. Certainly a SWAT team is not operating strictly like a Navy SEALs team would in rules of engagement. But the tactics and the style of dress and all of those things that come with that no-knock approach to going inside people's residences came directly out of the military special operations model. And one of the things our national level research exposed was that upwards of 50% of police departments were receiving training from active duty military special operations folks in the Navy SEALs and the Army Rangers. So there was not just a cultural link between domestic police militarization. There was a material one in that the U.S. military itself had all kinds of collaborative training agreements with local police departments. And, of course, this is still going on today, to train them in that way. Now, all of this was pre-9/11. So by the time 9/11 hit, we had certainly an acceleration of the trend. But the trend was well in place and well underway.
So how do we draw the distinction between policing and military activity? I mean, there are similarities, using weapons, using force to control people. I know police in general tend to be more involved in their communities, and certainly the military, genuine military activity of a war is not people working within their own community. They're interacting with an aggressor or someone they want to, someone who's labeled as an enemy. But how do you, as an academic working in the criminal justice system, define those two terms, police versus military?
Actually, what I've tried to do, and when I talk about this and don't, you know, of course, try to get too complicated with it, but just to simply view it on a continuum. So rather than the police are militarized or they're not militarized is kind of a silly proposition. The police, of course, always are going to have an element of militarization. In other words, they're going to be drawing from the military model for part of their appearance, part of their operations, and part of what they carry with them and the types of material goods they have. They're always going to draw off the military model. The question is the extent to which they fall down the continuum of being not drawing off that military model hardly at all versus drawing off that military model in an extreme way. And all I'm arguing is that based on national level data and lots of evidence and research that other people have put out, the U.S. police, the American police, have moved much farther down that militarization continuum in the last 20 to 25 years than they were previously, to the point now where you have some police departments that are conducting upwards to 500 to 700 Navy SEALs type raids on people's private residences, not trying to go after murderers, not trying to go after known felons, mostly going after small-time drug possessors and drug dealers. I would characterize that as going much further down the continuum than what any of us would have imagined for a civilian body of police.
In your testimony before the U.S. Senate committee, you referred to SWAT operations or to the fact that local police have increasingly added SWAT teams to their capabilities. I mean, in my naivete, I guess I'm thinking of a SWAT team as being the group that's called in when there's a hostage situation, when someone's life is in danger and a very dangerous person is holding people with weapons against their will. And the SWAT team involves sniper activity and the ability to take out the bad guy, for lack of a better term, and minimize the damage involved. But if you go there to the war on drugs, and then I guess we get to the examples you gave in your testimony about families who have children that killed or maimed as a result of the drug war. So why is it gone to that level? Why would local police be storming into the home of citizens looking for drugs or drug activity using military tactics? I mean, won't traditional policing suffice to handle those issues?
Well, I often hear from, and I guess I want to make one quick clarification. We do oftentimes, this conversation can devolve into a mindset of, well, either we have SWAT teams or we don't. And I think you gave some great examples of where a SWAT team, a use of force specialist, are absolutely necessary in an active shooter school situation, for example, a hostage situation. And traditionally, you're exactly right. That's what SWAT did. They handled those in-progress, reactive situations, and that was 90 to 95% of their work. But what we saw with the advent of the war on drugs is a reversal. We saw them go from almost exclusively doing those reactive situations to moving in a more proactive way and going out and actually creating work for themselves in doing these types of drug raids. Again, they didn't take place before. What did police departments do back in the old days, or what do smart police departments do today that haven't gotten into this craze? They just simply do good old-fashioned police work. They go out, they collect evidence, they do undercover work, they gather the information they need, and then they make an arrest in a safe, smart manner.
I mean, logistically and legally, how even does one of these home incursions, if I guess would be a term to use, how can that even occur? Can a police chief or, you know, a captain of a division of a police agency decide, we think so-and-so over here is... And I'm manufacturing drugs, dealing in drugs. Assume we're talking about relatively extreme cases. We don't assume that they're going to break into someone's home because they think someone's smoking some pot or using drugs privately. But how does that decision get made? Are there courts involved and permissions granted somewhere?
Well, we actually have some
pretty good research, and I know this is shocking to some people to hear because it just doesn't coincide with what they think of as routine policing, but we do have some really solid research that shows that actually most of these house raids are actually done for very small-level possessors and dealers. The evidence shows that the bulk of the time, get this, the bulk of the time, there's not even credible evidence to make an arrest. So in upwards of 60% of these no-knock and quick-knock entries, arrest isn't even made. This indicates that we're not talking about having a lot of evidence and going after big-time drug kingpins, people behind barricaded doors. We're talking about a situation that has really devolved into 500 to 700 raids a year, one police department inside people's private residences. And this is the key, using that as a tactic to collect evidence. And a more controversial part of it is using it as a tactic to also generate revenue.
I mean, aren't there legal repercussions on the police agency when there's not even evidence to arrest someone for breaking into to someone's home and, again, potentially injuring or killing someone?
As long as they can show the magistrate in their area that there's probable cause to conduct one of these searches, then that will, no matter what occurs during the course of the search, excluding some kind of tragedy, they have a legal right to be doing what they're doing. Now, some states have some curbs on no-knock and quick-knock entries, but the Supreme Court has been pretty clear on this. They are constitutional, and police can conduct them.
Dr. Peter Kraska is with us for this week's Eastern Standard. Dr. Kraska is professor and chair of graduate studies and research at the Eastern Kentucky University School of Justice Studies, a nationally recognized scholar in areas of police and criminal justice militarization, criminal justice theory, and mixed methods research. Our topic on this week's program, police militarization. Do you think that our police agencies have become over-militarized? Do you think that police agencies do not have the resources that they should have, today they do not have enough to do their job? We're interested in your questions, your comments, any personal stories of interaction with police that would cause you to either be concerned about police militarization or relax that concern. 800-621-8890. That's 800-621-8890. At WEKUEST is the Twitter address. We encourage you to follow us and then perhaps send us a direct message at WEKUEST. The email address, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Dr. Kraska, this note came in early prior to the show this week as we invite listeners to interact with us. I think we may have already answered this question. Do you think police should be better armed than civilians or vice versa? Do you think it should be equal? I guess there's a presumption that civilians are armed in general without getting into Second Amendment issues and so forth. What reaction do you have to that question, Dr. Kraska?
Well, I could go a few different directions with this, but since we've been talking about no-knock and quick-knock raids, it's probably worth mentioning that certainly a lot of people do have personal protection inside their homes, and the kinds of tragedies that I've worked on time and time again, not just the last few years, but over a 20-year career in this, those kinds of tragedies usually occur because somebody doesn't understand that it's actually the police that are raiding their home. And so they'll pick up their own personal protection and fire off a quick shot or stand in a doorway holding a weapon and they're killed themselves or a police officer gets killed themselves. And so, it's an important, I guess, dimension to note that one of the reasons why this quick-knock and no-knock raid phenomenon is so important is because Americans are well-armed, and they do oftentimes have personal protection. And sometimes in hard-living neighborhoods, they're going to be ready with that personal protection. And it can cause some real hardships. One of the most extreme examples was a man in Mississippi by the name of Corey May, And I worked on this case and helped out Radley Balco some with it. And it was just real tragic because he had nothing to do with drug dealing. The police were at the wrong residence. They broke into his house. He didn't know they were police. He had a three-year-old daughter at the time. He ran to her her bed, pulled her out of the bed, and hid behind the bed. And as the SWAT team entered his daughter's bedroom, he got a quick shot off and hit a SWAT officer in the neck and killed them. And Corey May ended up spending 10 years on death row, was almost executed three different times for a charge of capital murder.
When his belief was that he was defending his home and his family.
Absolutely. And on appeal, he ended up being exonerated of all wrongdoing. But again, he sat on death row for 10 years.
This is Eastern Standard. 800-621-8890 is our phone number. Police militarization, our topic on this week's program. Let's go quickly to Don from Whetstone, Kentucky. We have a couple of minutes before we need to take a station break. Don, you are on the air with Dr. Peter Kreska. Thank you for calling. Go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make the comment that I think local police forces, I think they will militarize as much as their budget will allow. I think that's just the way it works. But I think this is more of a judicial issue. As your guest was saying earlier, these guys are allowed to skirt the Fourth Amendment as far as a judiciary will grant them a warrant to do so. Okay, and I think that the extension of the police state that we have now is obviously a reflection on an apathetic citizenry who simply would rather be and feel protected as they would love to have their own liberty. Now, that's a very generalized, bold statement, I some would say, but I think that's what it all boils down to. Thank you.
All right, Don, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Peter Kreska.
Some good comments, Don. The notion of apathetic citizenry, I get asked all the time, why is this now just receiving attention? And it's funny because I sat in this very a WEKU studio and was interviewed by Eric Westervelt from NPR in 1996. And we did a full-blown show on this. This whole phenomenon hit the front page of the Washington Post. I probably did 60 interviews after that occurred, laying all of this out. And the bottom line is, except until very recently, the flashpoint was Ferguson. Nobody has cared, and nobody really has looked at it seriously.
Do you care, and what do you feel about this issue of police militarization? 800-621-8890 is our phone number. We're here for another 20 minutes on this week's Eastern Standard. Dr. Peter Kreska of Eastern Kentucky University School of Justice Studies, 800-621-8890. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKUEST. We're here for another 20 minutes on this week's Eastern Standard. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Police militarization, our topic on this week's program. Dr. Peter Kreska of Eastern Kentucky University's School of Justice Studies is with us. And the phone number is 800-621-8890. You are welcome to get involved in today's conversation. Send us an email if you choose, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or a tweet at WEKUEST. And I would be remiss if we did not mention that Dr. Kreska is going to be giving a lecture on campus at Eastern Kentucky University next week, part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series. Tell us about the direction that conversation is going to go, Dr. Kreska.
Sure. The title of it is All We See Are Nails, Using Militarism as a Problem-Solving Strategy. And so the Chautauqua theme is strategizing, and I just thought it might be interesting to explore how we strategize in terms of the assumptions we bring when we think about problem solving. And one of the assumptions we bring, at least in American policy, in American society, is the assumptions that come along with militarism. Very simply, not anything earth-shattering, a problem-solving mindset that focuses on use of force or the threat of using force to solve problems.
This lecture is next Wednesday evening, correct? A lot of the Chautauqua lectures are on Thursdays.
This one's on Wednesday.
And yes. This is at the O'Donnell Auditorium, is it called, I believe? More information is available, actually. We do have this listed on the events calendar at weku.fm, and you can search Eastern Kentucky University's website, eku.edu, for more information on next week's Chautauqua lecture. Usually, the folks who organize those lectures bring in experts from out of town, and they didn't have to go very far to find, a significant expert on this topic of police militarization. 800-621-8890, our phone number. Before we go back to the phone, our previous caller used the term police state, a pretty strong term, but that would be a question for our listeners. Are we moving into a situation of a police state as we talk about increased militarization of local state and regional police agencies? 800-621-8890. Let's go ahead and talk to David from Lexington. David, we understand you are a former police officer. Go right ahead.
Yes. I'd like to preface my comment by saying that my experience is limited to Buffalo, New York. I was a narcotics cop there for about 6 years and was involved with literally hundreds of no-knock. In New York State, you're allowed to get a no-knock clause on your search warrant. You had to apply separately for the no-knock permission. The same thing, you had to get permission to serve your search warrant after 6 o'clock at night. It was called nighttime service. So you had to get your search warrant, was one thing, but you also had to get the judge's permission to do the no-knock, and you also had to get permission to do it after 6 o'clock. So I guess my point is that your speaker, your guest, made it sound like no-knock clauses are just freely thrown out, and it's just anybody can get it, any police officer, for no reason at all. My experience in New York was you had to show the probable cause that the drugs were there. It wasn't a search warrant is simply a key to the door. It's not the end of the investigation. It's part of the investigation. It's a key to get in the door, but you have permission to get into the door. And in the cases I'm familiar with, we had to show what our probable cause was, that drugs were there, not that we just want to go on a fishing expedition.
And David, we're glad you called in because you've actually been there on the scene of such events. Do you feel that in such events that you were involved in, these no-knock situations, that you were justified, that those were all correctly executed, and that you all were acting within the law and really serving the citizens of the community by your actions?
I would think most of them were. I can honestly say there were a couple times where we had bad information, or the informant was wrong, or for whatever reason, we hit a place that we shouldn't have hit. And that has happened. I'd be foolish to say that we're 100% right. One of the reasons why we used no knock was because we never knew what was inside the house. You never knew who was, because otherwise you'd have to knock on the door and say, "This is Sergeant So and So. I have a search warrant for your house. Please open the door." And he had to do it 3 times. Knock on it. Say that. Now, what do you think the chances are that person still have the drugs with them after the police have knocked 3 times? They would run to the bathroom and start flushing the stuff. So one of our techniques was to shut the water off to the house before we would do our searches. So the guy only got 1 flush on the toilet.
Dr. Peter Kraska.
It's always wonderful to hear people coming out of local law enforcement and people that same kinds of people I work with every day in my career, and do a lot of work with police departments. And a lot of them absolutely do this right. A lot of them are very careful about the kinds of warrants that they pursue and how they execute them. Some of them have very strict decision-making matrix in terms of all of the criteria that have to be there in order to execute them. But all I'm saying is that the national level research doesn't indicate that your experience in Buffalo is typical. It's good that it occurred, and I'm glad to hear it, but the national level research doesn't indicate that that's the norm. The norm is that this thing has really devolved into going after a lot of small-time possessors and dealers, very minimal evidence involved, collecting cash, drugs, guns at times, and a very little positive benefit for the community that they're serving. Again, some police departments absolutely do it right. I could name police departments today that are doing it right, but that's not what the national level overall data demonstrates.
Police militarization, our topic on this week's Eastern Standard. We have a number of callers waiting. Thanks for being patient with us. We'll get to as many as possible. Very briefly, I want to make sure we include a comment that we got on Facebook from Lynn, who wrote, "I would like to commend Richmond's Police Department and Chief Larry Block for making the choice to keep officers as peace officers and not transform them into a militarized police force." Lynn, thank you for that message. Our program is focusing on the topic of police militarization. Let's talk now to John from Lexington. John, you are on the air with Dr. Peter Kraska. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yes, John, go right ahead.
I wanted to make one comment. One, on as far as SWAT teams with police agencies, I think they're like any other agency or any other person. If you've got it, you're going to use it. It's just natural. If you give a police department a new tool, you know, they're going to find new uses for it. And also, as far as your guest mentioned, the monetary issue or aspect of the drug seizures, and I think that's a real big part of what's going on with the war on drugs, and to some degree, in an ancillary way, these raids. I think the Supreme Court, what was it, 20-some years ago, opened up that gateway a lot more with a ruling on seizures of money and property.
And so the money and property are used by the police agencies and by the communities
and the cities and the counties and the federal governments. They get new SUVs. They get different things that they might need. But I'm not saying it's not needed or not put to good use in a way. But it gives them a monetary incentive to do these raids and do these seizures. I think that's something that needs to be kind of looked at, maybe.
John, thank you for your call to Eastern Standard. Dr. Peter Kraska.
Absolutely. It's a huge issue, and it's a larger issue in the criminal justice system. One of the ugly facts that came out after the investigation into Ferguson PD, now get this, 3 out of 4 citizens in Ferguson had an outstanding warrant for their arrest. This coupled with the fact that they found that the Ferguson government and Ferguson PD weren't focusing on serving the public good. They were focusing mostly on revenue generation. Now, let's hope Ferguson is a bit of an outlier, but we do know that the civil asset forfeiture phenomenon has gotten huge. Some police departments are funding 30% of their operations just doing civil asset forfeiture. So it absolutely gives them a strong financial incentive to go out and make the kinds of arrests and do the kind of searches that are going to yield the largest house, cars, material goods, and cash. Now, I have to say that I did a study back in 2003, I think it was, right here in the state of Kentucky, and I asked Kentucky police departments, what's the average amount dollar amount you seize? Are you going after drug kingpins, in other words, or is it just plain ordinary folks driving home from work? The average dollar amount I found was $300. Mm. $300. That indicates that there's more going on than just trying to hit the drug industry in the gut by stripping it of its finances.
800-621-8890. We may or may not have time for your call, but we appreciate it if you'd like to get on board for this week's Eastern Standard. 800-621-8890. Let us go ahead and talk to Mike from Berea, who's been on the line for a few minutes. Mike, it sounds like you have an interesting story about interaction with police.
Yes, sir. I'm a former infantry Marine. I served in Iraq, and my girlfriend was pregnant, and we were getting her a little exercise walking from my father's house, which is about a quarter mile up to the gas station in Berea, which is a very quiet town, if anyone knows it's listening. And we were stopped with the few broken windows excuse. Spotlight put on us, another unit called, and I didn't have my ID and told the man that I didn't. And, you know, these guys are stepping out of their vehicles, and they're wearing basically BDUs or military pants with a military, like, flak vest that says police on it. And, you know, basically they were harassing me. And I told the man as much and said that my dad's house is right up here. This is where we're going back to. And, you know, he gave me the excuse of, well, we've had some break-ins around here. And I said, well, of course you've had break-ins. You have a person living next to another person. And so some of my friends in this community here have had to take to, you know, driving because they didn't want to get harassed walking home after having a couple beers or coming back from a show or a party. And so I feel like, you know, it's this movement towards a town I grew up in when I was 14, 15. I rode my bike around town all night and had a blast. Didn't really do anything bad, just enjoyed being a kid. And now I know I could never, as a 14, 15-year-old, ride around here and not get harassed by the police. And coming back from Iraq and having served, when I saw the pictures of Ferguson and I saw these guys that could have just walked off of a direct entry team in Iraq on our shores, you know, our founding fathers warned us against this. They warned that a police force would eventually become a standing army. And it's used to nickel and dime a population in a time of economic crisis. Like, everybody's hurting. The governments are hurting. The police agencies are hurting. But like your panel here is saying, if you're getting $300 on average out of a stop, you're not going after the big guys, and you have one more mechanism for revenue production.
Mike, we want to get Dr. Kraska's reaction to your very important comments. And by the way, thank you for your service to our country. Sorry to hear about this negative experience.
Yeah, Mike, I think that's you make some really important points, and your story, I think, has a lot of a larger meaning to it, and I think you tease that out fairly well. It's important, you know, when you see a small town police department move to battle dress utilities or battle dress uniforms.
And why were the police in battle dress utilities that night in Berea, do you think, Dr. Kraska? Is that routine? Why not normal police uniform we might see, you know, throughout the day?
Right. The civilian blues are going to the wayside. And because it's not that how they dress is so consequential, because I get that criticism. What it does is indicate a mindset. And when a police department decides to go away from civilian blues to, you know, camo battle dress utilities or all black battle dress utilities, it indicates that they're thinking about policing in a different way, a different mindset. And it's very prevalent in small-town police departments. You have some small-town police departments that have only 25 officers, and 15 of them will serve on the SWAT team. 25 officers and 15 will serve on the SWAT team. Mm-hmm. Now, they're not doing SWAT raids. They're mostly doing patrol work, but they've got a SWAT mentality. That's problematic.
We have 2 minutes remaining in our conversation, Dr. Peter Kraska. I'd like you to take these 2 minutes and tell our listeners what you think needs to happen about this police militarization. Can it be turned around, and how could that occur?
Well, I've gone through kind of an interesting process. in working in this area for so long and studying it, and basically, you know, other than some really top-notch journalists noticing, nobody caring much. And because of some flashpoint situations and some real messes that have occurred, this is really, and obviously the cultural mood, this has really hit a new level of exposure. Unfortunately, I'm serving on White House commissions and testifying in the U.S. Senate and talking to various people, and all of the so-called solutions are very piecemeal, and nobody's looking at the real problems. For example, the battle dress utility is a cultural indicator of a real cultural shift in policing. And that cultural shift is...
They're thinking of themselves as soldiers.
That cultural shift is dangerous for our democracy. Absolutely. And those are some fundamental things we have to have a good conversation about and really think seriously about how to turn it around.
Dr. Peter Kraska, we need to talk again, and I think our listeners would enjoy an opportunity to interact with you again. So we're going to stay in touch. A very interesting resource that we've discovered just across the street from the studios of WEKU on the Eastern Kentucky University campus. We, of course, will tell listeners how they can interact with you if they want to reach you at the College of Justice and Safety on the campus at Eastern Kentucky University.
Yeah, I'm always open to email peter.kraska@eku.edu.
And listeners who write to us have a question that you want us to forward to Dr. Kraska, we'll be glad to do so. This program will be available as a podcast within the hour. We encourage you to continue the conversation on our Facebook page, or again, follow WEKU's Eastern Standard at WEKUEST by Twitter. Peter Kraska, our guest for this week's Eastern Standard, thank you so much for being with us. Oh, and the lecture. Let's not forget about folks who want to interact directly with Dr. Kraska. I assume they can talk with you, and there'll be a question and answer for the Chautauqua lecture next Wednesday evening.
Absolutely.
On campus at Eastern Kentucky University. This program was produced by Richard Turner. Our associate producer is Logan Riley. Brian Bartlett is our technical director. Julie Tennell has been on the phones. Eastern Standard is a production of WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. You'll find more information about this program and everything else on WEKU at weku.fm. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for tuning in.